is Monday, the 20th of June, and it is time to read from the Sioux City Journal. My name is Barb, and I will be reading to you today. We're going to start with the weather, see what's happening in the Siouxland area for the upcoming week, and then go back to the front page, read front page news of local, state, and national interest throughout the hour. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the next hour of news. Let's begin with the Siouxland five-day forecast. Today, windy and hot, a strong storm possible tonight, high of 98, low of 73 with a strong thunderstorm early. On Tuesday, periods of sun, high of 91, low of 63. Wednesday, partly sunny, high 90. Thursday, hot. Late thunderstorm in the area is possible, high of 94, low of 68. And on Friday, intervals of clouds and sunshine, high of 91. Sounds like a typical start of the summer, which will begin tomorrow. So let's go back to the front page and see what's happening. Our mini editorial today is written by the Journal Editorial Board, and they say the new multicolored LED lighting under the skywalks is a good addition to downtown Sioux City. And this is written by the Journal Editorial Board. All right, let's see what's happening. There's a lovely picture on the front page of Lewis and Clark, Ray Bubby Sorensen II, an artist who created the Freedom Rock Project, is painting a boulder at the Chris Larson Riverfront Park in honor of Sergeant Charles Floyd and Lewis and Clark. Excuse me, telling their story with a boulder. In Sioux City, after the death and burial of Sergeant Charles Floyd, Lewis and Clark spent a night beside the Floyd River before continuing upstream. East of Floyd Boulevard, approximately where the expedition team stayed for the night, a memorial rock is being painted with the story of Floyd, Lewis, and Clark from August 20th, 1804 to August 21st, 1804. Excuse me, Dan Whitlock, a member of the Sergeant Floyd Tri-State Chapter and the Lewis and Clark Trail Foundation, said the campsite in Sioux City has been known for years. After Sergeant Floyd was buried on the then unnamed Floyd Bluff, Lewis and Clark boarded their boats and went a short distance upriver before camping near what is called the Floyd River, according to their journals. The land to the west of the Floyd River, where the campsite was believed to be, was owned by the Andersons fertilizer suppliers. When the city started the Chris Larson Riverfront Development Project, the city was able to obtain that section of land. Now that property that we know is close, if not the exact place where Lewis and Clark camped, is part of the park. Whitlock began asking the city how they were going to honor the site around 2 years ago. The city had planned on putting up a sign, but Whitlock felt more could be done. He proposed hiring Bubby Sorensen II, the artist who created the Freedom Rock Project, to create something similar to honor Sergeant Floyd, as well as Lewis and Clark's campsite. Whitlock said it's another way to encourage people off of the highway and teach them about Floyd, Lewis, and Clark. We could provide more information and make another stopping point, he said. The city agreed to the project. The boulder, found near Anthon, was installed in October, and Sorensen was able to start painting on June 13th. Sorensen has been working on the project from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. every day since arriving. Titled the Floyd River Campsite Rock, there are five images on the boulder. Floyd's sickness, his burial, the Lewis and Clark campsite, the portrait of Floyd, and an American flag with 15 stars and stripes. In the period between 1795 and 1818, the flag had 15 stars and stripes, despite the country having had more than 15 states, beginning with the admission of Tennessee in 1796. The number of stripes went back to 13 in 1818. Whitlock said the painting is expected to be finished by June 20th, with an informational signage to be installed at a later date. He hopes to have everything in place for an August 20th dedication ceremony. The project is estimated to total around $35,000 to $40,000. It is being completely paid for by the Sergeant Floyd Tri-State Chapter. He said they have raised $33,000 $770 from private donations, company donations, and grants from the Lewis and Clark Trail Foundation and the Missouri River Historical Development and Fund for Sioux City. Looks like a great addition to our riverfront. All right, in other front page news, January 6th panel sets sights on Pence and Ginny Thomas. In Washington, members of the House committee investigating the Capitol riot said Sunday they may subpoena former Vice President Mike Pence and are waiting to hear from Virginia Ginny Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, about her role in the illegal plot to overturn the 2020 election. Lawmakers indicated they will release more evidence about Donald Trump's alleged effort to defraud supporters by fundraising off false claims of a stolen presidential election. They also pledged to provide pertinent material to the Justice Department by the end of the month for its criminal investigation. The department complained in a letter last week that the committee was complicating its investigation by not sharing transcripts from its 1,000 interviews. "We're not taking anything off the table in terms of witnesses who have not yet testified," said Representative Adam Schiff, who described a Pence subpoena as certainly a possibility. "We would still, I think, like to have several high-profile people come before our committee," he said. For example, the committee has been able to document most of Trump's end of his call to Pence on the morning of the insurrection on January 6th, when the then-president made his final plea for Pence to stop the certification of Joe Biden's victory when Pence presided over the Electoral College count in Congress. Members have not yet documented directly what Pence said in response. The committee chairman, Benny Thompson, a Democrat from Mississippi, recently said the committee was still engaging with Pence's lawyers, who also, while also suggesting that it might not be necessary for him to appear because of testimony from many of Pence's closest aides. Committee members also hope, to learn more about Ginny Thomas's own effort to keep Trump in office and the potential conflicts of interest posed on her husband as a result of the January 6 cases that come before the Supreme Court. Republican State Representative Rusty Bowers, the Arizona House Speaker, is scheduled to testify at the committee's hearing on Tuesday, focusing on state officials who were contacted by Trump and the White House as Trump tried to overturn the results. Bowers is likely to be asked about emails he received from Thomas urging him and other state officials to set aside Biden's 2020 win and choose their own set of electors. "We have questions for her and questions for him," said Zoe Lofgren, a Democrat from California. Thomas has publicly indicated that she can't wait to appear before the committee after receiving the request by letter last week. Along with emailing Arizona officials, Thomas, who attended a rally Trump held just before the Capitol riot, also had written to then House White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows in the weeks after the election, encouraging him to work to overturn Biden's victory. Emails recently obtained by the committee also show Thomas had email communications with John Eastman, the lawyer who played a key role on behalf of Trump in efforts to pressure Pence to overturn the election. "I think the committee will be interested in, among other things, whether this was discussed with Justice Thomas, given that he was ruling on cases impacting whether we would have get some of this information," said Schiff. This past January, Thomas was the lone member of the court who supported a bid by Trump to withhold documents from the January 6th committee. Lofgren said the committee would release additional evidence it has gathered on the big ripoff in which the committee alleges Trump may have committed fraud by fundraising by making a false claim the election was stolen. Representative Adam Kinzinger, a Republican from Illinois, said that in the end, the public will have a clear picture of the failure of the oath by Trump. "I think that what we're presenting before the American people certainly would rise to a level of criminal involvement by a president," he said. Kinzinger also said that he and his family have received threats because of his role on the committee. He spoke of his concern that there's violence in the future, and until we get a grip on telling people the truth, we can't expect any differently. Schiff appeared on CNN's State of the Union, Lofgren on CBS's Face the Nation, and Kinzinger spoke on ABC's This Week. Council to vote on hot car ordinance. This would prohibit owners from keeping pets in a hot vehicle. In Sioux City, the Sioux City Council will be asked Monday to adopt an ordinance that prohibits individuals from keeping animals in a vehicle or in the bed of a parked truck in ambient temperature that exceeds 79 degrees Fahrenheit, unless the animal is enclosed inside the vehicle with the air conditioning turned on. Chris Wall of the Sioux City Animal Adoption and Rescue Center said the change to the city code is not being proposed in response to any increase in people leaving animals in their vehicles on hot days. I think that the message, in all honesty, is getting through to people. We're getting calls for them. But typically what has happened is by the time we get there, the people have gone. Excessive heat is open to interpretation, Wall said. What they've done now is that they're bringing in a 79-degree Fahrenheit ambient temperature outside, so everyone's in the same ballpark. Everyone is on the same page. The current city code has a nonspecific requirement that animals not be kept in vehicles during conditions of temperature extremes. This will supply police and animal control personnel with an enforceable, quantifiable threshold condition. Under the current city code and the proposed amendment, any peace officer or animal control officer is authorized to use whatever force is reasonable and necessary to remove any animal from a vehicle or other enclosed space whenever it appears that the animal's life is in danger by the extreme temperatures or lack of ventilation. The officers would not be liable for any damage caused to the vehicle or other enclosed space. It becomes a priority one situation if there's an animal in distress in a vehicle. That's pretty much drop what you're doing and get to that call, said Wall. Wall said he couldn't recall any situations last year or so far this year that involved Sioux City Animal Control officers or police having to break out a vehicle window in order to rescue an animal. He said anyone found in violation of the proposed ordinance would receive a multiple infraction penalty. The first offense is $100 plus cost for a total of $195. All right, other front page news. Zelensky praises Ukrainian fathers. In Kyiv, Ukraine, one photograph shows a kneeling soldier kissing a child inside a subway station where Ukraine families shelter from Russian airstrikes. In another, an infant and a woman who appear on the brink of tears look out from a departing train car as a man peers inside, his hands spread across a window in a gesture of goodbye. In an uplifting Father's Day message on Sunday, Ukrainian President Zelensky posted 10 photos of parents and children set against the grim backdrop of war, praising fathers who protect and defend the most precious. There are scenes of childbirth as a man and woman look toward a swaddled baby in what appears to be a hospital room where the spackled walls show scars of fighting. In another, a man lifts a child over a fence toward a woman with outstretched arms on a train platform. Being a father is a great responsibility and great happiness, said Zelensky, followed on Instagram. It is strength, wisdom, motivation to go forward and not give up. He urged his nation's fighters to endure for the future of your family, your children, and therefore the whole of Ukraine. His message came as 4 months of war in Ukraine appear to be straining the morale of troops on both sides, prompting desertions and rebellion against officers' orders. NATO chief warned the fighting could drag on for years. Combat units from both sides are committed to intense combat in the war. Ukrainian forces have suffered desertions in recent weeks, and Russian morale highly likely remains especially troubled. It's said cases of whole Russian units refusing orders and armed standoffs between officers and their troops continue to occur. Separately, the Ukrainian main intelligence directorate released what it said were intercepted phone calls in which Russian soldiers complained about frontline conditions, poor equipment, overall lack of personnel, according to a report by the Institute for the Study of War. In his nightly address Sunday, Zelensky said the week ahead would be historic and perhaps bring Ukraine closer to membership in the European Union. But that move could portend a more hostile response from Russia, he warned. EU leaders recommended Friday that Ukraine join the bloc, and the proposal was to go to members for discussion this week in Brussels. Zelensky called the outcome of those talks one of the most fateful moments for Ukraine since independence from the Soviet Union in 1991. I am sure that only a positive decision meets the interests of the whole of Europe, he said. In such a week, we should expect greater hostile activity from Russia, and not only against Ukraine, but also against Europe. We are preparing. Britain's defense ministry said that both Russia and Ukraine have continued to conduct heavy artillery bombardments on axes to the north, east, and south, but with little change in the front line. One of the governors said via telegram on Sunday, "It's a very difficult situation where the enemy in the middle of the city is conducting round-the-clock aerial reconnaissance with drones, adjusting fire and quickly adjusting to our changes." Russia's defense ministry claimed on Sunday that Russian and separatist forces have taken control of Melitopol, a settlement just to the east. Bakhmut, a city in Donbass, is 33 miles southwest of the twin cities of Luhansk and Severodonetsk, where fierce military clashes have been raging. Every day, Russian artillery pummels Bakhmut. But Bakhmut's people try to go about their daily lives, including shopping in markets that have opened again in recent weeks. "In principle, it can be calm in the morning," said one resident. "The shelling starts at 7 or 8 in the evening. Still, it's been pretty calm in the past 10 days or so. You can buy food at the small farmer markets," said a teacher. "It's not a problem. In principle, educational institutions like schools and kindergartens are not working due to the situation. The institutions move to other regions. There is no work here." All right. I think that does it for our front page coverage. We'll move inside to other stories of interest. Moving to page 3. Electronic sniffing dog helps in pedophilia arrest. Haidu, an electronics detection dog, was trained to sniff out a certain chemical used in the manufacture of small memory devices and memory cards. 3 weeks ago, we learned that Nelson M. seemed to be active in Mexico and was a serious danger to children. Matman was apparently so sure of himself, he talked openly about his activities on the internet. But Mexican prosecutors were ready to work with the non-governmental organizations. Operation Underground Railroad quickly set up a plan to lure Matman into a trap using chat rooms and social media spaces he was active. So the Mexico City detectives waited while Matman showed up at a bus station near a gas station on June 5th. He was found to have a pistol and several doses of cocaine in his possession. Matman is being held at a Mexico City prison on charges of human trafficking, drug, and weapons possession. He does not have an attorney of record, nor could he be reached. Our understanding was that he was entertaining offers from other people wanting to go into business with him, apparently to sell a trove of sexually explicit material involving young children. The problem was he was caught at a bus stop and not at his home. No one knew where he was living. No one knew where he could have stashed any child sexual abuse material, which is usually held in digital form. So city prosecutors used a network of street surveillance cameras to trace his movements back to a dingy apartment he was renting on the city's rough east side. Tall and with reddish hair, the Dutchman stood out in that area. Once police obtained a search warrant, that is where Haidu came in, a black lab having been trained at an academy in Indianapolis. TPPO is a chemical used in small solid-state memory devices to avoid overheating. There is just enough of its distinctive odor for dogs to locate. Jordan started out by training his dogs to look for accelerants in arson cases and then moved to training electronic detection dogs. He now has 83 and counting that have been trained to find flash drives that store everything from contacts to cryptocurrencies used in drug deals. I think the electronic dogs have now surpassed the accelerant canines because of just the need of them and just because of the way the world is right now. The dogs can intercept internet crimes and be used by task force to help. Haidu was brand new at the work. He had just graduated 2 weeks ago. Haidu and his handler flew to Mexico City, where prosecutors were just about to search the apartment. My understanding is that there was a cell phone hidden in a laundry basket with terrible-smelling laundry, but the dog found the phone. Haidu also found more child porn material taped to a wall beneath a painting. The dog sniffed out a couple of the hard drives in a few places in his apartment that were difficult for humans to find, but the dog sniffed it out. Buzz Lightyear stumbles. Jurassic World takes number one at the theaters. Lightyear did not go to Infinity and Beyond in its first weekend in theaters. The Pixar's first major release since March 2020 blasted off with $50 million in its debut weekend in North America, according to studio estimates on Sunday. Not only did it open lower than expected, but Jurassic World Dominion held on to the first place spot with $59 million in its second weekend. It's a mixed bag for Disney and Pixar as Lightyear, an origin story about the movie that inspired the Space Ranger action figure in the Toy Story movies, is one of the biggest launches for the animated family film over the pandemic. Including international showings, it grossed almost $86 million. But expectations were higher because the release was based on a high-profile, beloved, well-known character. Some analysts had pegged Lightyear for a $70 million debut. Expectations are always incredibly high for a Pixar movie, especially one with direct connection to the Toy Story brand. Toy Story launched Pixar in 1995, and its four films have made over $3 billion. The family audience has proved a little more reluctant than other segments to go back into the theaters. Many studios, including Pixar and Disney, have opted for streaming or hybrid releases for their animated titles. Since the beginning of the pandemic, the company has sent its Pixar titles, Soul, Luca, and Turning Red, directly to Disney Plus, free for subscribers. There have been a little confusion about whether it's just in the theater or not. And we're going to move to the next story. Iowa doors swing open for Republicans eyeing the White House. Many GOP hopefuls plan visits to the Hawkeye State. In Cedar Rapids, the polls were closed in Iowa for less than 48 hours when South Carolina Senator Tim Scott was shaking hands and posing for pictures with Eastern Iowa Republicans at a Cedar Rapids country club last week. Scott, one of the many Republicans testing their presidential ambitions, hardly has the state to himself. At least a half a dozen GOP presidential prospects are planning Iowa visits this summer, forays that are advertised as promoting candidates in the state Republican organization ahead of the fall midterm elections. But in reality, the trips are about building relationships and learning the political geography in the state scheduled to launch the campaign for the party's 2024 nomination. While potential presidential candidates have dipped into Iowa for more than a year, the next round of visits marks a new phase of the ritual. With Iowa's June 7th primary out of the way, Republicans eyeing the White House can step up their travel and not worry about stepping into the state's intra-party rivalries. Now that it's done its full bore, said the GOP chairman, it's unfettered. Beyond Scott, former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley is expected to visit late this month and plans to campaign with as many Iowa congressional Republican candidates as she can in little more than 2 days. Haley, who is a former governor of South Carolina, another early voting state in the presidential calendar, plans to begin her trip in eastern Iowa on June 29th. She'll headline a state GOP fundraiser in Dubuque. Working from the Mississippi Valley westward, she plans to keynote a fundraiser for Governor Kim Reynolds. Haley will also campaign with Zach Nunn, chosen to face two-term Democratic Representative Cindy Axne, who is among the most vulnerable House members this year. Haley's still fluid schedule also includes attending Randy Feenstra's annual fundraiser in the GOP-heavy western Iowa. Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton, who visited several times in 2021, is expected to the first week in July to speak at a county GOP dinner in Story County. Former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who has visited Iowa more often than any other GOP prospect, is working out details for a late summer return, likely timed to the Iowa State Fair in August. Pompeo endorsed Nunn before the primary, a nod to their shared military experience. The plans also come in light of the Republican National Committee's unanimous decision in April to open the 2024 presidential selection sequence in Iowa, a question still hanging over Iowa Democrats. In 2020, a smartphone app designed to calculate and report the Democratic caucus's results failed, prompting a telephone backlog that prevented the party from reporting final results for nearly a week after the February 3rd contest. The Associated Press announced it was unable to declare a winner after irregularities and inconsistencies marred the results. Stripped of their automatic special status in April, Iowa Democrats are trying to salvage their leadoff spot with a plan to allow early participation by mail and streamline the sometimes time-consuming process. With Joe Biden in the White House, Democrats with White House ambitions have largely kept their distance from Iowa. Senator Bernie Sanders, the Vermont independent who won the 2016 caucuses and was the final candidate to drop from the 2020 contest, was in southeastern Iowa Friday to rally support for the United Auto Workers striking at the CNH agricultural machinery plant. Sanders' plans, which also included a stop in southeastern Wisconsin, sparked questions about whether the 80-year-old has a third White House bid in mind. He said he wouldn't challenge Biden if the president sought re-election, and Sanders' advisors said there had been no stated change in his plans. 6,000 bees removed from a wall of an Omaha couple's home. Buzzing in the wall made the bees' presence obvious. About 6,000 bees were recently removed from inside the walls of an Omaha couple's 100-year-old home. Thomas and Mary Lou Gutierrez told the Omaha World Herald they have been planting bee-friendly flowers outside their midtown home, but they never expected the bees to move in. Bees likely infiltrated through a hole in the mortar of its brick exterior. They discovered the bees after noticing many were flying outside their kitchen window and found about 30 in a second-floor bedroom. If you put your ear to the wall, you could hear the buzzing, said Gutierrez, a retired dean at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, who used to lead the Center for Afghan Studies there. Gutierrez said his first thought was to call an exterminator, but we've been reading, and there are a lot of great shows on PBS Nature about how important bees are to pollinating the world in which we live. The couple contacted two members of the Omaha Bee Club, who charged $600 to safely relocate the bees. Larry Cottle of Countryside Acres Aviary cut a hole in the wall of the home before Ryan Gillian of Gillies Gold vacuumed the bees into a box to move them. Three honeycombs about 2 inches thick and roughly 9 inches in diameter were inside the wall. Gutierrez said he and his wife tasted some of the honey before Gillian took the bees home to his acreage. Gillian said he's removed bees from a number of homes, apartments, barns, and trees in the past 7 years. The last home he did before theirs had 15,000 bees. That's a lot of bees. Tax holiday is an idea. This is a story about the U.S. economy and rampant inflation. In Delaware, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said Sunday that she expects the U.S. economy to slow in the months ahead, but a recession is not inevitable. Yellen offered a dose of optimism even as economists grow increasingly worried about a recession fueled by skyrocketing inflation and the Russian invasion of Ukraine. She also expressed an openness during an interview on ABC's This Week to a federal gas tax holiday to help give motorists some relief at the pump. Several lawmakers have floated the idea, as the average price of gas hovered around $5 a gallon. The tax is 18.4%, 18.4 cents per gallon. That's an idea that's definitely worth considering, said Yellen. When asked if the administration is weighing it, she added that President Joe Biden wants to do anything he possibly can to help consumers. The Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm said it's one of the tools, but told CNN's State of the Union that part of the challenge with the gas tax is that it funds the roads. Yellen said overall consumer spending in the U.S. remains strong, while noting that spending patterns are changing, given the impact of rising food costs and energy prices. Yellen said household savings during the coronavirus pandemic will help sustain spending. The national savings rate has fallen to about 6%, below pre-pandemic levels, after reaching 16% in 2020, the highest on record since 1948. I expect the economy to slow, she said. It's been growing at a very rapid rate, and the economy has recovered, and we have achieved full employment. I expect a transition to steady and stable growth, but I don't know a recession is at all inevitable. Yellen echoed Biden's optimism in the face of economic headwinds. Biden, in an interview with the AP last week, insisted that a recession is not inevitable and made the case that the U.S. is in a stronger position than any nation in the world to overcome this inflation. Disagreeing with the assessment from Biden and Yellen, former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers told NBC's Meet the Press that in his estimation, the dominant probability would be that the end of next year, we would be seeing a recession in the American economy. The Federal Reserve on Wednesday approved its largest interest rate increase in more than a quarter century to stem a surge in inflation. The move raised the target Fed funds by 0.75% to a range of between 1.5 and 1.75. The tightening of a monetary policy was accompanied by the downgrade to the Fed's economic outlook, with the economy now seen slowing to a below-trend 1.7% rate of growth this year, unemployment rising to 3.7% by the end of the year and continuing through 2024. Yellen said it will take skill and luck to bring down inflation while maintaining low unemployment. I believe it's possible, she said. All right, we're going to continue on now. Arizona wildfire, 40% contained. A lightning-caused wildfire that led to an evacuation of the Kitt Peak National Observatory southwest of Tucson is 40% contained, authorities said. More than 300 firefighters were working the wildfire on Saturday. If all goes as planned, the blaze could be fully contained by next Sunday. The Wind Whip fire started June 11th on a remote ridge on the Tahoe Reservation about 8 miles southeast of Kitt Peak. It has grown to 27 square miles before rain fell on Saturday. The fire was at 30 square miles by Sunday. Flames had reached Kitt Peak by Thursday, and officials evacuated a small community north of the mountain. Four nonspecific buildings on the west side of the observatory property were destroyed, but authorities said early indications show the fire did not damage the telescope. Heat wave grips Spain and Germany. Bathers cool off Sunday at the Isar River, which flows through the middle of the Bavarian capital of Munich, Germany. Amid hot, dry, and windy conditions, German officials said their residents of three villages near Berlin were ordered to leave their homes Sunday because of an approaching wildfire. Temperatures in Germany and Spain rose over 100 degrees over the weekend. In other news, French President Emmanuel Macron's Central Alliance was projected to lose its majority despite getting the most seats in the final round of the parliamentary election on Sunday, while the far-right national rally appeared to make large gains. In the Philippines, Sara Duarte, the daughter of the outgoing populist president of the Philippines, took her oath Sunday as vice president. Following a landslide electoral victory, she clinched despite her father's human rights records. In Colombia, leftist former rebel Gustavo Petro held a slim lead in the presidential runoff election over the real estate millionaire and was on the cusp of ushering in a new era of politics in the South American country. Petro has 50.6% of support, while the former mayor had 47%, with more than 97% of the ballots counted. Germany's economy minister said Sunday that the country will limit the use of natural gas for electricity production amid concerns about possible shortages caused by a cut in supplies from Russia. Germany will try to compensate for the move by increasing the burning of coal, a more polluting fossil fuel. Other world news. In India, massive flooding and mudslides in northeastern India's Assam state have claimed more than 8 lives. The death toll now increasing to 62 from weeks of heavy rains that have caused one of Asia's largest rivers to overflow. The Disaster Management Agency said 32 of the state's 35 districts were underwater when the swollen river broke its banks, displacing more than 3 million people. In Blackjack, Missouri, two men charged in fireworks explosion that killed 4. Two men were charged with murder in a house explosion near St. Louis that authorities said killed 4 people who were assembling fireworks in a garage. St. Louis County prosecutors said that 2 people made fireworks and directed younger people on how to load the canisters and attach a fuse for lighting. They would then sell the fireworks to others. Neither of them had a license to make or sell fireworks. Both people are charged with 3 counts of second-degree murder and several other charges in Friday's explosion near the town of Blackjack. They were charged before a 4th victim died on Saturday. All right, we're going to go to other news. Title IX's next battle, rights of transgender athletes. When the gender equity legislation known as Title IX became law in 1972, the politics of transgender sports was not even a blip on the national conversation. Today is one of the sharpest dividing points of American culture. As the transformational law heads into its second half century on the books, the Biden administration wants transgender athletes to enjoy the same protections Title IX originally gave to women when it passed 50 years ago. That stance is at odds with efforts in states across the country. We're at a time where Title IX is going to be exploited and celebrated. But people aren't going to look at the underbelly because it's complicated and nuanced. It has always been complicated and nuanced. Without federal legislation to set parameters for this highly technical issue, on the front line of a culture divide that also includes abortion rights, gun control, and replacement theory, among other topics, high school athletic associations and legislatures in no fewer than 40 states have filled the void on their own. There are some 15 million public high school students in the U.S., and a 2019 study said that 275,000 are transgender. The number of athletes within that group is much smaller. A 2017 study by the Human Rights Campaign suggested fewer than 15% of all transgender boys and girls play sports. Yet as of May, 19 states have passed laws banning or restricting transgender participation in sports, despite the general lack of a problem to address. Other measures do the opposite, allowing gender identity to determine the athlete's eligibility. There are a myriad of rules and guidelines in place across the country, state to state, and sometimes sport to sport or even school to school. The debate essentially boils down to advocates who want to protect the space Title IX carved out for cisgender women, women whose gender identity matches the sex they were assigned at birth, and those who want transgender athletes who compete as females to enjoy the same protections as anyone else. Consensus is nowhere in sight, and the fights are piling up. Last fall, the American Civil Liberties Union and others filed a lawsuit against Tennessee's ban on transgender athletes playing school sports. I was really looking forward to trying out for the golf team, boys golf team, and if I made it, training and competing with and learning from other boys and improving my games, said a student. Then to have the legislature pass the law that singled me out and kids like me to keep me from being a part of a team that crushed me and hurt very much. I just want to play like every other kid. All the transgender, anti-transgender legislation hits home for Kayla Patterson, who was able to play soccer after the Iowa High School Girls Athletic Union adopted regulations for the inclusion of transgender girls in 2014. When I was in high school, people called me a monster because I was bigger than the other girls, she recalled. That's what they see us as now, especially in the Republican Party in Iowa. They don't see us as human, but they see us as predators. The complexity of the debate is also placed sport icons in peculiar positions. Many have been long time at the forefront for equality in women's sports, and they want to include transgender athletes in mainstream sports, but to ensure cisgender females remain in the mix to win, insisting trans athletes have an advantage in a participation gap by default. And it continues to be a debate as we move forward. So, okay, we're going to continue on now to other news. Let's move to the world of sports. Actually, we're going to do the economy before we go to sports. How high will prices go? Several factors are converging to increase the cost of gasoline. There is little evidence that gas prices, which hit a record $5 a gallon on June 11th, will drop anytime soon. Rising prices at the pump are a key driver in the highest inflation that Americans have seen in 40 years. Everyone seems to have a favorite villain for the high cost of filling up. Some blame President Joe Biden. Others say it's because of Russia invading Ukraine. It's not hard to find people, including Democrats in Congress, who accuse the oil companies of price gouging. As with many things in life, the answer is complicated. What exactly is happening? Gas prices have been surging since April 2020, when the initial shock of the pandemic drove prices under $1.80 a gallon, according to government figures. They hit $3 in May 2021 and cruised past $4 in March. On June 11th, the nationwide average for a gallon ticked just above $5 a gallon, according to AAA, which has tracked prices for years. The average price jumped 18 cents in the previous week, and that was $1.92 higher than this time last year. State averages range from $6.43 a gallon in California to $4.50 in Mississippi. Why is this happening? Several factors are coming together to push gasoline prices higher. Global oil prices have been rising, unevenly but sharply overall since December. The price of international crude has roughly doubled in that time, with the U.S. benchmark rising nearly as much, closing June 10th at more than $120 a barrel. The Russian invasion of Ukraine and the resulting sanctions by the U.S. and its allies have contributed to the rise. Russia is a leading oil producer. The U.S. is the world's largest oil producer, but U.S. capacity to turn oil to gasoline is down 900,000 barrels of oil per day since the end of 2019. Tighter oil and gasoline supplies are hitting as energy consumption rises because of the economic recovery. Finally, Americans typically drive more starting around Memorial Day, adding to the demand for gasoline. What can be done to get more oil? Analysts say there's no quick fix. It's a matter of supply and demand, and supply can't be ramped up overnight. If anything, the global oil supply will grow tighter as sanctions against Russia will take hold. European Union leaders have vowed to ban most Russian oil by the end of the year. The U.S. has already imposed a ban, even as Biden acknowledged it would affect American consumers. Biden said the ban was necessary so that the U.S. does not subsidize Russia's war in Ukraine. Defending freedom is going to cost. The U.S. could ask Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, or Iran to pick up the slack for the expected drop in Russian oil production, but each of these options carry its own moral and political calculations. Republicans have called on Biden to help increase domestic oil production by allowing drilling on more federal lands and offshore, or reversing his decision to revoke a permit for a pipeline that could carry Canadian oil to Gulf Coast refineries. However, many Democrats and environmentalists would howl if Biden took those steps, which they say would undercut efforts to limit climate change. Even if Biden ignored a big faction of his own party, it would be months or years before those measures could lead to more gas at U.S. service stations. Why is the U.S. refining down? Some refineries that produce gasoline, jet fuel, and diesel, and other products shut down during the first year of the pandemic when the demand collapsed. While a few are expected to boost capacity in the next year or so, others are reluctant to invest in new facilities because of the transition to electric vehicles will reduce demand for gas over the long run. The owner of one of the nation's largest refineries in Houston announced in April that it will close the facility by the end of the year. Who is this hurting? Higher energy prices hit lower-income families the hardest. Workers in retail and fast food industry can't work from home. They must commute by car or public transportation. 20% of the families with the lowest income could be spending 38% of their income on energy, including gas, this year, up from 27% in 2020. When will it end? It could be up to motorists themselves. By driving less, they would reduce demand and put downward pressure on prices. There has to be some point where people start cutting back. I just don't know what that magic point is. Is it going to be $5? Is it going to be $6 or $7 per gallon? That's the million-dollar question that nobody knows. Good information. We're going to move now to the world of sports, and we're going to just do a quick update. Bandits lose in semifinals. Omaha defeats Sioux City 49-45 for a trip to the CIF championship. As the final pass of Saturday's 49-45 Sioux City Bandit loss to the Omaha Beef fell to the ground, there was a mixture of emotions. For the Beef, there was joyous victory that they're on to the championship game, but for the Bandits, there was disbelief, frustration, and ultimately heartbreak. When we brought this team in, this group of guys, it was pretty much championship or bust. And unfortunately, we couldn't get it done, said head coach Irv Strobing. This group of guys mean the world to me. They're all good people. I'm friends with them all and love them to death. As a coach, it's the hardest thing. The top-seeded Bandits hosted fourth-seeded Omaha in the semifinals, a rematch of the 2021 semifinal that the Beef won by 1 point. The regular season matchup in the Tyson Event Center was a dramatic finish as well, when the Bandits scored late to take down the Beef 60-49. After a back-and-forth first half, the Bandits took a 34-28 lead at intermission, but ultimately lost 49-45. All right, in other local sports, Claiborne sweeps weekend from Explorers, the Railroader homers down Sioux City. Claiborne Railroaders sweep the Sioux City Explorers as they take Game 3 of the series 7-5. Claiborne got off to a start as hot as the afternoon temperature, scoring 4 runs in the first, and ultimately won to win 5-3. I believe 5-4. No, I'm sorry, that's not the final score. 7-5 was the final score. All right, another. Fioto wins 88th Annual Sioux Valley Match Play. The 88th Annual Sioux Valley Match Play was held at the Cherokee Golf and Country Club in Cherokee this weekend. Fioto defeated Sam Story and Colin Mitchell Sunday to take the title on the championship flight on Sunday. And Matthew Fitzpatrick wins the U.S. Open at Brookline at the Country Club in Brookline, Massachusetts. A playoff was looming Sunday in the U.S. Open, just like it always does at the country club, when Matt Fitzpatrick sized up his shot from a bunker left of the 18th fairway. He had a one-shot lead over Will Zalatoris and Masters champion Scottie Scheffler. He had a big patch of rough-filled turf in front of him, along with a gaping bunker, protecting the green and the flag, which was 156 yards away. Nothing less than a U.S. Open title was on the line, and he wins it with a 2-under 68. The Englishman, a major champion for his first professional win in America. He won the U.S. Amateur at Brookline in 2013, making him only the second man to win a U.S. Amateur and a U.S. Open at the same course. Jack Nicklaus is the other name on the gold winner's medal draped around his neck. So good for him, and congratulations. All right. I think we're running out of time. I'm going to do, one last thing. Stanley Cup Final, best of seven games if necessary. Game one was won by the Colorado, as was game two. And game three will be in Tampa Bay tonight, Monday night at 7 p.m. So I'm going to do a quick recap of our weather. It's going to be hot. It's the first day of summer tomorrow, and the weather is matching that part on the calendar. Let's look at the specifics. Today is going to be very warm, a little bit of wind, high of 98. Tonight, low of 73. Tomorrow, sunny and 91. Wednesday, sunny and 90. Thursday, hot with a possible thunderstorm in the area, high of 94. And clouds and sunshine on Friday, high of 91. I hope that you've enjoyed today's reading of the Sioux City Journal. My name is Barb, and I have enjoyed reading to you. Our thanks to the Sioux City Journal and also to the Iowa Reading Radio Network. Thanks for joining us, and have a great week.